Should the government have the right to police a musician's work? A federal judge in Louisiana recently ruled that the rapper BG, who wrote the hit song Bling Bling, must let the government review the lyrics of any future songs before he releases and promotes them. Man, I got these bras icing it up while my little BG's on a bus putting out cigarette butts. The rapper served time on firearms and other charges, and the decision was one of the conditions of his continued early release from prison. Prosecutors had asked the judge to impose much stricter restrictions. No associating with people convicted of felonies, no self-employment, no leaving his home state of Nevada. It's certainly not the first time a rapper's lyrics have come under scrutiny by a criminal court, raising concerns about free speech. We've called Alexandra Kazarian. She's a criminal defense attorney in Los Angeles, and she joins us now. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you very much for having me.
Can you tell us a little more about why this federal judge said BG, whose legal name is Christopher Dorsey, why he has to let the government review his lyrics?
Sure. I think the judge actually made a great ruling because the prosecution was really trying to make sure that he wasn't able to work, essentially. And what the judge did was say, no, but I am going to allow the prosecution to review any new lyrics to see if they're in conflict with the goal of rehabilitation that supervised release gives. So if, for example, he is rapping about snitches going down, well, the government is going to argue that that is inciting violence against people who are cooperating with the government. That's not in line with rehabilitation, and he should go back to prison because he's not at the point of rehabilitation where he should be released. So the judge kind of met them in the middle and said, I'm not going to stop him, but I am going to allow the government to make an argument if they think that the lyrics are problematic.
I think a lot of people would be surprised that the government could be allowed to do something like that.
It's a fine line, but when you're on supervised release, you're giving up your rights in order to be out in public. And so when you're on probation or parole or something like this, it's something that you agree to do. And so the question is, how far can the government go?
If at some point BG submits some of his lyrics to the government to review, and prosecutors decide to ask a judge to send him back to prison, what is the judge going to be looking for in those lyrics before making her decision?
So now that he is on supervised release, it is about his character. So the question is going to be, is he rehabilitated enough to be out in public, or does he need to go back to prison? So they're going to be looking for lyrics that promote violence, lyrics that promote violence against people who cooperate. One of the issues was there was a lyric that he was rapping with in his first post-release show where they were lyrics that were about two men that were in prison currently on life sentences for murder that was part of a drug deal gone wrong, and there were disparaging remarks about a snitch. So this is what started the whole thing. The government came back and said he's inciting violence against snitches and he's glorifying murder during drug deals. This is not evidence of rehabilitation. This is not somebody who's sorry that he was found with guns and drugs 14 years ago in his car. He's the same person he was back then. He hasn't been rehabilitated. Put him back in prison. So that's what they're looking for, is actual character evidence inside of those lyrics.
This isn't the first time that a rapper's lyrics have been used against him in a courtroom. Snoop Dogg's lyrics were hauled into court when he faced charges in the 90s. The rapper Young Thug's lyrics came up in his ongoing trial on charges he was involved in gang activity. Why does the government see lyrics as a useful prosecutorial tool?
Well, I think the government sees rap lyrics as a useful prosecutorial tool. I don't think that they see any other genre as where the lyrics are so useful. Because there's this sense that rap lyrics are autobiographical. There have been studies that show that if you tell somebody in a blind study that these lyrics are from a rap song, that people will view that person, that artist, as having a character that is more disposed towards criminal activity. But if you give them the same exact lyrics and tell them that it's a folk song or a metal song or a country song, they'll laugh it off and say, no, that's just art. So I think the government has that same exact mindset, that if somebody is rapping about violence, it's because they are a violent person. And in court, that's not supposed to come in. Bad character evidence is not supposed to come in to prove that a crime happened. Evidence of the crime is supposed to come in, but your character isn't supposed to be assaulted.
Your firm has a lot of celebrity clients, including musicians. If you were BG's lawyer in this case, how would you advise him just in terms of sitting down to write his next song?
There's already been an infringement on his First Amendment rights, because when he sits down to write a lyric, he isn't just thinking about his life and about his art. He's thinking first and foremost about the government. So there's a chilling effect. And I would encourage him to write. I would encourage him to write honestly. Probably not about killing snitches, but I would encourage him to write honestly. And then once he does, we'll decide whether we're going to submit those or not. Or can you just wait until you're off of supervised release?
I've been speaking with Alexandra Kazarian. She's a criminal defense attorney here in Los Angeles. Thanks so much for being with us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
In 2020, California's legislature did something no state has ever done. It created a task force to look at the legacy of slavery in the U.S. and at the history of racism in California and how those histories have harmed the state's black residents, and to suggest possible ways the state could atone for that harm. The California Reparations Task Force laid it all out in an 1,100-page final report. And it made a blockbuster recommendation that California should pay the descendants of enslaved people who today live in the state cash reparations. So a year later, where does this effort stand? Earlier this month, California lawmakers set aside $12 million in the state budget for reparations. Not for cash payments, though, for other things. Although cash payments have been the reparations movement's central goal, both in California and nationally, politically it's been tough. For more, we called on NPR race and identity correspondent Sandhya Dirks. And when we spoke, she began by explaining how California got to this point.
So reparations for slavery is something Black people have been fighting for since even before slavery was abolished. But at the national level, there's really never been enough political support. Then 4 years ago, after George Floyd's murder by police in Minneapolis, there was this moment. Protests and conversations about racial justice. So lawmakers in California said, maybe we can do something. And they set up this reparations task force to study the state's history of racism and suggest concrete ways to atone for that history.
So tell us about what this task force did.
Well, it spent 2 years collecting expert evidence and testimony, holding public hearings across the state, and then last summer it issued this report recommending a long list of policies aimed at closing racial gaps in wealth, health, education, and achievement, things like free college tuition, housing aid, tax breaks. But the biggest recommendation was for California to make cash payments to the descendants of enslaved people, in some cases, hundreds of thousands of dollars or more.
So that was a year ago, and now this week we learn that the new state budget will include $12 million for reparations. So is that for those cash payments?
No. I mean, so far there's been no movement on cash payments. The $12 million is money for, as of now, unspecified legislation. It could go to a slate of bills introduced by members of the Black Legislative Caucus to address some other parts of the task force's report.
Like what?
One bill would end forced labor in state prisons. Another would provide grant money to combat violence in Black communities. And another would do something simple but deeply symbolic, accept responsibility for California's role in upholding slavery. It also recognizes the state's role in perpetuating systemic discrimination that exists to this day. Another bill would create a California Freedmen's Bureau, named for the agency set up after the Civil War to help formerly enslaved people. The idea is that Bureau would help create the infrastructure for administering reparations.
So, Sandhya, are there any bills that would actually, compensate people?
Well, there is one. State Senator Stephen Bradford introduced what people are calling a land back bill. It would enable the state to compensate Black people whose land it took using policies like eminent domain. There's a long history of that tool being used for racist reasons.
California's budget is almost $300 billion, that's with a B, $1 billion, Sandhya. So $12 million set aside in this year's budget for reparations doesn't sound like very much. Can the state really do anything meaningful with that money?
Well, I asked that question of State Senator Stephen Bradford. He's also a member of the Reparations Task Force, and he admits the amount is basically budget dust.
Does $12 million come close to healing or addressing all the massive wrongs and continued, you know, vestiges of slavery and discrimination? But it lets folks know that we're serious about it. It's a beginning.
He and other supporters of reparations say, while it's not a lot of money, it's a symbolic amount, and that it's a bookmark or a promise. Camila Moore, who led the state's reparations task force, also says it's a good start.
And I'm hoping to see more legislation that gets at direct benefits to descendants of slaves in this next legislative session. But I think it was a good idea for the California Legislative Black Caucus to start off with bills that relate to more structural policies.
So, Sandhya, I mean, it sounds like lawmakers and even some advocates are sort of framing this money as an important first step. But what about the cash payments? Is there just no support for that?
There just isn't enough. State Senator Bradford has said so himself. Governor Gavin Newsom has also publicly been very tepid on the idea of cash reparations. They say it's largely a budgetary issue. And these are all Democrats. Among Republicans, there's even more opposition. James Gallagher is the state assembly's Republican leader, and he doesn't think cash reparations are what's going to close racial gaps.
Yes, I think in our current society, there are not impediments to, Black Americans succeeding. But are there things in history that have certainly put Black Americans behind in terms of being able to build wealth? Yeah, I mean, I think we know that's true.
And he also says it's just not fair for taxpayers today to have to pay for injustices of the past. But Adrian, to be clear, it's not Republicans holding up these more robust reparations. Democrats have a supermajority in the California legislature. If they wanted to make this happen, they could. Gallagher told me he feels like this is all a performance with very little substance to back it up.
And to me, like, what Democrats continue to do in this situation is act like they're doing something in terms of reparations, but not really doing it.
What's so interesting is that grassroots reparations activists are saying something very similar. As we heard earlier, some are framing the $12 million and the bills as a solid start. But for Black people in the state who saw this as a chance for California to do something big and bold, there's a feeling of frustration, like things are already being watered down.
If reparations are proving so tough to pass in California, you know, one of the most progressive states in the country, what does that say about prospects for the broader reparations movement going forward, you think?
Well, it's always been really hard to get public support for reparations. Poll after poll has found that aside from African Americans, there's just not a lot of support for cash payments. Some polls have found that the general public don't believe Black Americans deserve reparations. The post-Floyd racial justice movement that led to this big momentum for reparations, it's dissipated. Democrats have kind of dropped it. And on the right, there's been an outright backlash, what some activists call white lash. Many prominent conservatives have made an issue of denying systemic racism is real. And there's also a growing movement to challenge programs that address systemic racism in court. Now, all of that said, California reparations advocates are not giving up. And the state is still engaged in one of the largest scale efforts to compensate people for historic racism in our country's history.
I've been speaking with NPR race and identity correspondent Sandhya Dirks. Thanks.
Thanks, Adrian.